Hi, I'm Michael Williams, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. We hope you enjoy this conversation, which took place as a co-presentation between Sydney Writers Festival and Sydney Festival in January of this year.
Well, good afternoon, and welcome to Carriage Works for this very special Sydney Festival, Sydney Writers Festival event. What a remarkable thing. Look at you all. I can't quite believe you're there. You are the most magical, imagined thing that we've dreamed of for the past year. A live audience in a room. The erudite and the curious, the perspicacious and the engaged. You're there. In fact, give yourselves a big round of applause for being in a theatre, being people out in the world for public conversation. What a thrill. So good to see you. My name is Michael Williams. I'm the Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival, and I'm coming to you from Wurundjeri country of the Kulin Nation here in Melbourne. This session might be about predictions and prognostications, but the one thing that seems to defy predictions in this country at the moment is borders between different states. And so sadly, rather than being there in the room with all of you, I am doing this remotely, but no less thrilled that we've come together for Sydney Festival to give you a taste of Sydney Writers Festival and the year ahead. You are, of course, gathered on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation, land that was never ceded by its traditional owners. The moral and legal implications of invasion remain unresolved to this day. Now, we're thrilled to be back in a theatre, and one of the reasons we're back in a theatre is that we couldn't wait till April and the Writers' Festival re-emerging to start to unpack a little bit of what's been going on for the past 12 months. It's been, to put it mildly, a monster of a year. So we were keen to gather you and some of our greatest minds. You're some of our greatest minds as well, of course, but others on the stage to reflect on the year that's been and to offer us their professional opinion about what might be just around the corner. If we hear again and again that 2020 was unprecedented, what does 2021 look like? More unprecedented activity? Or do we somehow find a way out of the morass of the year that was? But before we get to predictions, we're going to kick things off with someone going the other way and looking back at the year as it has been, just in case any of you weren't paying attention. Maxine Benaber-Clark is the author of over 10 books for children and adults, including the critically acclaimed childhood memoir, The Hate Race, the Australian Book Industry Award-winning short fiction collection, Foreign Soil, the Victorian Premier's Award-winning poetry collection, Carrying the World, the Boston Globe Horn Prize and Children's Book Council of Australia Award-winning picture book, The Patchwork Bike, and her latest book, When We Say Black Lives Matter. In 2019, she was the inaugural Poet Laureate for the Saturday Paper. Joining you via screen from Melbourne, please welcome Maxine Benaber-Clark.
Fire moves faster. 1. South of the equator, the summer that lit the year on fire was combustible. The cotton sweat slick of shirt to back, air so humid, the world turned in slow motion, far-flung ash settling to dust on grimy city windowsills. The sour smell of singed flesh drifting on the wind as wild things whimpering padded scorched and tender feet towards outstretched bottles of volunteer Mount Franklin. The summer that lit the year that was flew magpies so traumatized in their mimicry. They wailed like sirens, indistinguishable from death's call. January was dark smoke spreading in the distance as all kinds of folk glanced up. As they boarded the tram to work, got the lawnmower out, hung the washing, took a break from their word doc or bung the teen coffee pot on saying, Jesus, mate, look at that sky. You just know that can't be good. February was small town apple-eyed folk, faces tear-tracked and racked with hiccup sobs on the early evening news as they stared down the barrel of ABC Rural, smouldering amidst the embers of all they thought they knew. And in March, catastrophe had leapt the brake. collecting up sticks, seed pods, dry grass and brittle undergrowth. Anything was tinder, whatever would take. 2. The news out of China was street spray downs and hazmat suits. There were these clips circulating of officials brute handling those who broke the isolation rules. We heard tell of mask mandates and the harsh seal of infected citizens into their own rooms. Watching from below the equator, it seemed strange, apocalyptic, what was happening in Wuhan. At first, we thought the virus was unknown quantity. Then they said they had named it COVID-19. In March, it ravaged Italy and we saw, my God, just what this virus meant to do. Saw morgues too full to take the bodies on trolleys, lining the walls of hospital hallways, rasping beneath thin standard issue sheets, and the doctors and nurses, well, they were dying too. Looking back, Italy was the moment we all knew that something wicked this way wandered. Fire moves faster when travelling uphill. The virus slipped in on unwashed airport hands at Melbourne International. The virus hitched a ride in the eager lungs of working cruise shop youngsters. The virus nonchalantly dropped anger in the New South Wales ports. To some, it was nothing compared to what arrived 250 years before. We knew the fever, the shadow on lung, the way it broke the body down, but what we never really thought about was how we'd watch our loved ones die alone. How bone-tired nurses would hold iPads to their faces and do their fearful best to show, despite the empty room, the face shields, the absence of any human touch for days. They were thought about, and they were loved. And there were people who prayed. Some lauded that the virus could hunt you down, no matter who you were, no matter where you lived, no matter what you earned. But that was back before factory workers were put off, before 100 days of lockdown, before well-to-do folk bought the supermarkets out of toilet paper, canned goods, hand sanitizer and meat, before chemists had no emergency Flixitide left and none available on order for your asthmatic kid, and chain hardware stores sold out of veggie seeds and white goods places had a run on deep freezers. That was before they sealed the public housing towers up. And we saw the brown and rightly angry faces staring down at us from hundredfold windows as they trucked in one cop to every 5 residents. And in reality, no one quite knew or cared what the real infection numbers were out of India or Brazil. While some of us queued for food and housing, celebrities broadcast themselves singing, imagine all the people. RT news crews shot footage of cherubic choir boys singing in the center of empty cities, took poignant stills of playgrounds closed off with cautionary tape. Newspapers ran pics of small children pressing heartbroken hands against grandma's window-peeking face. On the first day of online learning, my hopeful daughter wore her uniform to the kitchen table. 3. May arrived, and on a daylight street in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a swagger, cocky white cop knelt on the neck of an unarmed black man for over 9 minutes until he ceased to breathe. In May, George Floyd was asphyxiated By callous knee of an officer, by cruel might of state, and under crushing weight of colony, George Floyd was run down by the slave hounds that never stopped sniffing the air to smell our blood, never stopped snarling at black folks' heels. When George Floyd cried, "Mama, Mama," when George Floyd said, "I can't breathe," every black childbearer and every black child heard their own child cry for mercy, saw through centuries, felt the lick of overseer's whip splitting proud black skin, felt the sharp and weeping smart of plum red flesh, the desperation and indignity. Fire travels faster when burning uphill. But June came the strength of proud black people. June came the fervor of our righteous rage. In Bristol, protesters sunk a cast of Edward Colston in the harbor. In Washington, they almost tore Andrew Jackson down. And in Ghent, King Leopold II was doused in paint, the crimson color of Congo artery. Oh, the streets were awash with black and yellow. June was a march of red and green. Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter! In Australia, the press gave more space to deaths in custody, and just for a moment, you could taste a dream. Later in October, as the Melbourne lockdown lifted, they would quietly fell a Jabwarung tree. 4. In Victoria, during the first wave, it kind of became ritual. The premier standing before the press and the people crowded around their home TV sets, jostling to hear. When you think about it deeply, it kind of sung of war. On Saturdays and Sundays, the premier wore North Face, and on weekdays, a signature dark suit. The chief health officer, Brett, soon garnered a cult following. The pin-ups of 2020 could rock a statistic. Some looked hot in both heels and health policy. Could pull off that lab coast scientist chic. I mean, you couldn't meet for Tinder dates, but all the swipe rights design contact tracing systems in their sleep. Get yourself a bae who can hook up a ventilator and will wash their coffee cup too. Lanky teens stacking supermarket aisles on Thursday nights had more certain employment than the dentists did. In some ways, the new status quo was delightfully fucking weird. I mean, the world was a trash fire, but it was all avoidable. Your kid's playdate at school with that child you think is a terrible influence? Book club with Jenny who insists on chewing jats with her mouth wide open. The pap smear you got a reminder for 2 months ago, I mean. It's selflessness, really. You can't go now. You wouldn't want to clog up the health system. The courage to quit that job that's been giving you stress eczema for going on a year. You could just pocket JobKeeper. Netflix and Uber Eats while you wait, and who even knows? Maybe you'll get redundancy pay. Introducing your new partner to your dad and mum. Yeah, nah, sorry. I mean, we're all in lockdown, but we wish we could come. Routine was tuning in between 10 a.m. and 1 to check out what was happening with the curve. Pollies and journos spun their usual crap. That Tim Smith downstate who can never shut up at the best of times was always mouthing off about Daniel Andrews this and Daniel Andrews that. and Rachel Baxendale from the Murdoch Press tied up every COVID press conference with tedious I got yous. Barrett Jacklin got involved with this real shady ass bloke. I mean, it was like, sister, just nope. And Scott Morrison fucked up trade deals left and right, souring diplomatic ties like a small, stubborn child, and spent the rest of his time cavorting with Hillsong. Because no matter what happens, politics rolls on. 5. Planes were grounded. Motor cars slept streetside. Birds repopulated silent cities. Some said the upside was they had never breathed air so clean. But trauma does not reverse so easily. A tornado ripped through Sumatra Island. The Taal erupted in the Philippines. Bush burn raged through Colorado and California, through Falconbridge and North Mead. The Atlantic ran out of the English alphabet when christening hurricanes that season. Fire burned faster when traveling uphill. 6. By November, Washington was a sea of white flags, each solemn planted for one of the dead. And when election rolled round, the early voters queued the block. The exit poll showed it was largely black women and Native American voters who stood up and shouted out, and in united numbers, got the job done. President Trump tried every avenue to beat them back, but the roads were all painted with Black Lives Matter. The victory, well, it wasn't much, but it was also just enough. Firearms faster when climbing up. For a moment, we forgot the pandemic and the floods and the shootings and the blasts. We forgot to wonder where next month's rent was coming from. And the whole world stood and watched in awe as decent Americans packed city street sides, singing Mariah Carey from subwoofed rides, as they formed Philadelphian street parades, as Chicago fireworks shone and flash mobs were made, as Harlem hodgepodged marching bands and New York crowds made cool jazz hands. The whole world stood and watched in awe, and the United States of America partied its way to a brand new dawn. 7. Sometimes you don't want to think too much about the year that was, you know? The 1.6 million empty places at the Kwanzaa, the Hanukkah, and the Christmas table. The elders you'll Skype because you still can't see, and the lockdown weight so many still carry. All the small and poignant ways we couldn't help but have to change. How you scrub your hands a little too hard these days at the bathroom sink, and how most nights, despite going to bed early, you still can't get much sleep. The handful of emergency cans you now insist on keeping, and the flinch when some stranger or other passes by. The distance between us, and how easily you cry. There is hope in little things. Watching the zucchini plants flower, sharing a meal with friends, loud children playing tag in the park again, and realizing now you know your neighbor's name. How a mass of screaming bodies on global city streets can harness the voice of an entire people. What a city can overcome. What ordinary people will muster to give. And how fiercely we realized, we all will fight to live.
That was the extraordinary Maxine Vanita Clark. A big round of applause for Maxine. 2020 was definitely lived in prose, so it's been very nice to get a chance to relive it in a poetic form. It was actually 200 years ago this year, back in 1821, that Shelley celebrated poets as the unacknowledged legislators of the world. And now in 2021, we have Michael McCormack as an acting prime minister. So you decide whether that's progress over the centuries or not. Now, turning our gaze to the future, and we have one of Australia's finest journalists, Kate McClymont, investigative journalist with the Sydney Morning Herald. She's a seven-time winner of journalism's most prestigious award, the Walkley, including a gold Walkley for her coverage of the Bulldog salary cap rorts. She was named 2012 New South Wales Journalist of the Year for her investigations into the fraudulent activities of Michael Williamson and former New South Wales Labor Minister Eddie Obeid. In 2017, she was inducted into the Media Hall of Fame for her contribution to the industry. Her latest book, Dead Man Walking, tells the complete story of the lives and shoddy, shoddy business deals of Michael McGuirk and Ron Medich. Please welcome the extraordinary Kate McClymont.
Oh my God, it's so amazing to see actual people in a room. It's fabulous. So thank you so much for having me here today to talk about our prediction, prescriptions and wild hopes for the year ahead. And what a horrible year has just gone by. Anyway, one prediction that I have for the coming year is that Zoom meetings will continue to expose more than just our technological incompetence. Now, a friend of mine is here in the audience today who was on one of those calls with academics overseas. She thought she'd turned her camera off and proceeded to get changed to go to the gym, including bending down and changing her clothes. Trini Woodhall, the UK fashionista, was doing a live Zoom call. She had some kind of a face, I don't know, not a mask, but some kind of application on her face, when her husband, Charles Saatchi, who used to be married to Nigella Lawson, walked past in the background completely naked. Completely naked. But the most sensational Zoom exposure led to the New Yorker magazine firing one of its star journalists, Jeffrey Toobin. Now, Toobin, a former assistant US attorney, wrote extensively on legal matters ranging from O.J. Simpson murder to the impeachment hearings of President Donald Trump. Now, he was in a Zoom call with his colleagues, thinking he had switched off his camera and turned the mute button on his computer, Toobin proceeded to switch to a second call to engage in phone sex. His colleagues were horrified when Toobin's genitals loomed large on their screen. Talk about a cocker. Now, my prescription there is mute, mute, mute. And if you can't do that, just please put some clothes on. Now, as the new year springs upon us, I find myself embroiled in the mysterious disappearance of Dover Heights woman Melissa Caddick, who hoodwinked family and friends into handing over millions of dollars, which was spent maintaining her extraordinarily lavish lifestyle. So what she was doing was the money that was coming in from new investors was being paid out to the few investors who asked for some of their money back. Now, her unemployed hairdresser husband has developed a side business of breeding prawns in his home aquarium, which can't be doing too well since he told the court he only has $1.95 in his bank account. Now, former Border Force boss Roman Quadvaleg tweeted that there was now a new crime genre, the Prawnsy Scheme. Now, I have received a number of crazy predictions from our Herald readers, and these are direct quotes. She may be hiding in her house in a panic room that hasn't been discovered as yet. Mrs. Caddick is currently living in a small half cabin cruiser moored in Sydney Harbour. She gets Deliveroo dropped off each day and has not gotten off the boat as yet. She has ordered several production quality prosthetic full face masks that she plans on using next month so she can go and see her parents incognito. She will be taking the appearance of a man. The next one. Would it be possible that this lady bought citizenship from Vanuatu? You can get a passport for $150,000 US. She manufactured her disappearance and can be found on the New South Wales mid-north coast lying low. Or she's staying in Penrith at Thornton. I've seen her go on her jogs in the morning near the cricket pitch. This woman spent 12 months creating a new identity. She used that new identity to leave Australia via Brisbane Airport after chartering an evening private flight from Bankstown Airport. My own hope will be that she turns up on James Packer's yacht, which she has persuaded him to turn into a massive prawn trawler on which they entertain high-rolling gamblers. Now, tomorrow sees the resumption of the criminal trial involving Eddie Obeid, his son Moses Obeid, and former colleague Ian McDonald. Now, this trial, which has been running close to a year, is up to closing submission stage, and a verdict should be handed down within the next couple of months. Now, my prediction is that Eddie will be relocating to new premises this year, and I can guarantee this prediction is 100% going to be correct. And that's only because the Obeids have sold their house in Hunters Hill for $11.5 million and they're renting it back until October and then they have to move out. But my hope is actually that Eddie will be in a very small room, courtesy of Her Majesty's pleasure. Now, on a more serious note, my other ardent hope for the year is that there will be defamation reform. And even hearing the word defamation just makes me die inside a little bit. They are the bane of my life, and I seriously would rather get a death threat than a lawsuit. In recent years, I have been sued by then 96-year-old Morgan Ryan. He was the solicitor involved in the My Little Mate Lionel Murphy affair years ago. He claimed my articles had ruined his business. I mean, the guy was 96, like seriously. And luckily he discontinued, but not until a huge amount of time and money we had been spent tracking down the old age tapes, tracking down witnesses who could attest to his lack of reputation. Of course, there's the famous Eddie Obeid case, who Eddie sued the Herald and me successfully for the imputation saying that he was corrupt. And I have been sued in Wisconsin, of all places, by a dodgy Australian businessman. The businessman, an undischarged bankrupt who was then living in Wisconsin, told the Milwaukee County Court that the offending article had hurt his business deals. Apparently, he was on the cusp of signing a $100 million deal with an aircraft manufacturer when my article came along and ruined that for him. But even more upsetting to him was that the story had badly affected my ability to find a lady in my life. This is what he told the court. On many occasions, ladies I met were initially pleasant, and then when they did a Google search on me, they literally slammed the phone in my ear, he told the court. He also claimed that the article caused him to lose his natural smile. I noticed it when I went to comb my hair in the morning. This is not the same me I once knew. To me, it looked like my face had set like cement. Now, I have been accused of many things in my life, but causing someone's face to set in cement is anew. Now, there were two good things about this case. One, that Judge Richard J. Sankovitz dismissed it, saying that it would offend due process. But the other good thing was I found the Herald had 11 paid subscribers in Wisconsin. So it was win-win. So whereas London was once the defamation capital of the world, defamation reforms in the United Kingdom in 2013 means that that dubious title now goes to Sydney. On a per capita basis, Sydney has 10 times the number of defamation cases than London. And a defamation lawyer, Matt Collins QC, said Australia's laws were now a Frankenstein's monster of rules and exclusions and prevented good journalism from investigative reporters. There are important, high-profile stories that can't get told because of the chilling effect of defamation law and the high cost of actions, said Matt Collins. And funnily enough, it's no coincidence that our defamation laws, which are among the most restrictive of any Western democracy, is at the same time we are the only Western democracy without a charter of rights or, you know, freedom of expression. But there is a ray of light. New South Wales has agreed to amend the defamation laws, but they are yet to be enacted. And one crucial amendment is the new requirement that the plaintiff must prove he or she has suffered serious harm to sue. Now, there was a really interesting case that was handed down at the end of last year. And this is a case where ABC journalist Steve Kinnane was sued by two former doctors involved in the Chelmsford Hospital scandal. In his 2016 book, Fair Game, which was about Scientology in Australia, one of the doctors, John Gill, was mentioned once in the book. The other doctor, John Heron, was mentioned 12 times. And it was in a chapter about a Scientologist nurse smuggling out patient records to show what was going on at Chelmsford. Kinnane quoted the scathing findings that had been made against the two men in the Chelmsford Royal Commission report, which was handed down in 1990. The Royal Commission investigated Chelmsford's use in the 1960s and 70s of a dangerous experimental treatment known as deep sleep therapy. And this involved rendering patients unconscious for days on end with barbiturates. And while they were unconscious, they were subjected to electroconvulsive therapy. 24 of their patients died. Dr. Gill was later charged with manslaughter and maliciously inflicting grievous bodily harm. However, a jury never heard the charges because the High Court permanently stayed the proceedings when it ruled that the deaths happened too long before. To prosecute would be an abusive process, the court found, but that didn't stop them suing all these years later. Heron was struck off as a doctor in 1997 over other allegations of professional misconduct as a psychiatrist. So HarperCollins applied to the federal court to have the case thrown out, saying it would be virtually impossible to prove the truth of these allegations, given that the events being sued over occurred 50 years ago. They also questioned what reputation the two men had that could further have been damaged by a book that sold 8,500 copies. And for instance, you know, as to their reputation, Royal Commissioner John Slattery had found that Dr. Gill was a most unsatisfactory witness who was prepared to lie when the occasion demanded. Not only did he continue his delusional attacks on innocent people in the witness box, he showed not the slightest remorse or compassion regarding the deaths of patients and rejected all criticisms in the face of overwhelming expert opinion of his culpability, Slattery found. But the law was the law, and the judge said the defamation trial had to go ahead. But here was the rub. The author and the publisher could not rely on the conclusions of the Royal Commission. To defend themselves, they would need to prove all over again what the Royal Commission found was true. And this is what the judge said. I accept that the present case will be complex. I accept also that if the respondents, Mr. Kinnane and the publisher, are intent on defending the proceedings on the basis of truth, they may be beset by the difficulty, if not the impossibility of the task, given that so much time has passed, said Justice Jago. But the trial did go ahead. And against all odds, Kinnane and HarperCollins relitigated the Chelmsford case and won. And in a biting judgment, Justice Jago found that Gill and Heron were fixated on using the defamation case to rewrite history and vindicate their conduct, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary. Kinnane said the proceedings took over 3 years and cost millions of dollars. And although they were ordered to pay costs, Heron is 87 and has no money. Gill, 78, owns a house, and they are apparently considering an appeal. So the changes to the defamation laws will mean that people like Gill and Heron will first have to convince a court that they have suffered serious harm. I can't tell you that, you know, how vital this change and other changes will be once they are enacted. So I want this year to bring much-needed reforms to the chilling effect Australian defamation laws have on our journalism. And if that is done, I'll be able to write more stories that you deserve to hear. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Kate. More stories from Kate McClyman is a prediction that I think we can all get behind. One of the key figures of public conversation in this country across 2020 was Dr. Norman Swan. He's the host of RN's Health Report and co-hosts CoronaCast, a daily podcast on some obscure medical thing that I'm not entirely across, but I understand that it's a phenomenon. Norman's also a reporter and commentator on the ABC's 7:30, Midday, News Breakfast and Four Corners, and a guest host on RN Breakfast. He's a Gold Walkley winner and created Invisible Enemies on Pandemics and Civilization for Channel 4 in the UK and 27 other countries. He has the Medal of the Australian Academy of Science, an honorary MD from the University of Sydney, and this year's Australian Skeptics Journalism Award. He trained in medicine and paediatrics in Aberdeen, London and Sydney. Please welcome, via screen, Dr. Norman Swan.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much, Michael. I too would like to acknowledge the land on which I'm speaking from, which is Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and elders past, present and future. I'd also like to acknowledge the huge success that's often not been trumpeted amongst community-controlled organisations and remote and regional Aboriginal communities, that COVID never really got into those communities. And that's because the federal government had the sense to leave it to those communities to organise the controls, their self-preservation, if you like, themselves, and a huge success, and congratulations to all. And also congratulations to people in government for allowing self-determination to take place, and a really important thing. So we've heard from Maxine about the past. This is about the future, as Kate was saying. I haven't been as much of a customer of defamation as Kate has recently, although I have in the past, and I completely endorse her call for reform as a way of freeing up the sort of journalism that we all deserve and that Kate has delivered in spades. So what comes next? What's this year to come? What's the prediction? Well, if we just go to the past a little bit for that, we do tend to get obsessed with beginnings. And the beginnings in terms of pandemics always look bad, will often look bad. But in fact, what comes next, I'm sorry to say this, is often worse. So if you look, for example, at the 1918-19 pandemic, we always talk about the 1918 flu pandemic, but in fact, it was 1919 into 1920 when it became a complete nightmare. And by the way, it was a particular nightmare in the United States. The United States did very badly in the 1918 to 1920 flu pandemic, for almost the same reasons that it's done badly today, is that the American culture of individualism above all else, freedom above all else, freedom of speech above all else, mitigates against the sort of community and cooperative response that you need in a pandemic to control it. And I often quote the figures in World War II in prisoner of war camps, where American soldiers had a higher mortality rate than British and Australians. And the theory was it was individualism. They didn't look after each other. There wasn't a strong sense of mateship as there was amongst the Australians and the British and the South Africans and so on. So in the 1918-19 pandemic, things got worse after year one. The Black Death arrived in the 1340s in Europe, killed a very large percentage of the European population very quickly. But what's not often realized is that it then lasted for 300 years. And that was the second pandemic of the plague and died out just after the Great Fire of London. But the worst was to come after the bad and nightmarish as it was in 1340. It was considerably worse after that and paralyzed Europe in many ways. And created change, which I might come back to as well. And the change wasn't all for the bad. Syphilis, similarly, syphilis was almost certainly brought back on Columbus's ships from the New World. And his sailors couldn't get work after the first voyage and became mercenaries in the siege of Naples. And they took syphilis there and syphilis exploded. And this was the siege by the French of the Italians. And the Italians called it the French pox. The French called it the Italian disease. And we know what happened with syphilis after that, a dreadful disease which has never gone away. So, am I here to cheer you up? You'd be disappointed if I really started to cheer you up, wouldn't you? I mean, you really want me to bring doom, death, and destruction. So we've got a tough year ahead. We've been told for a year now this will only be over when a vaccine comes. And we've got vaccines now. We are a little bit behind other countries with introducing vaccines. We've done incredibly well, but the vaccines may not open us up the way we hope they might. They may not prevent transmission. I think they will. We are going to get the Astra vaccine mostly, and that will, that at the moment looks like a safe vaccine. It's reasonably effective at preventing disease, but may not get the transmission down to the sort of levels we want to prevent prevent transmission and open borders up and return life to some sort of relaxed normal. But I think that what's happening, why we've had this, one of the reasons we've had this pandemic is the least of it is the biology of bats and the SARS-CoV-2 virus. It landed on the world when the world was losing faith in liberal democracy, when fragile autocrats, we think of autocrats, they're called strongmen, Orban, Xi, Trump and so on. They're not Putin, they're not strongmen at all. They're autocratic weak men, and they have to be autocratic because they are so weak. If they were truly strong, they would have responded in different ways. So this virus landed on a world with people with fragile personalities trying to hold on to power through autocratic means, including the United States. And that meant that we were landed on a time where we've had an unparalleled cooperation between countries. I think my prediction for this year is an increased and continuing crisis in liberal democracy. It's terrible to say so, but I think that is going to continue to be the case. You're going to see fragmentation in the United States. What happens this week has terrifying potential in the United States and around the world. In the days after, in the years and centuries after plague, we saw fragmentation. There was fragmentation of religion. There was loss of faith in the priesthood. There was the seeds of the Reformation. There were flagellants in the streets. There was blame and victimization. And it was a horrible period brought on biologically by this plague. And my prediction, unfortunately, I hope I'm wrong, is that this plague will actually decrease stability, increase instability, create more conflict, and we'll have this toxicity through social media, which social media will not be able to control. Yeah, they've closed down 70,000 accounts, but the genie is out of the bottle on whichever social medium you want to look at. and it's fueling this crisis. And I hope I'm wrong, but we'll see autocracy rising. What's my prescription for the future? Well, I actually wrote a book as part of my prescription for the future, which was, well, not prescription for the future, it's my way of dealing with it, which was nothing to do with COVID. So it's really just occupational therapy. It's valuing the small stuff. It's that we are living smaller lives than we did, but most of us have found out that's not too bad. And we appreciate what is around us. We appreciate Australia, what Australia has to offer. And it's been marvelous how the community governments have been able to control this pandemic. We came perilously close to losing it, but we've done incredibly well. And it's the community that's done well. As Kamalini Lukuge, a researcher at the ANU, says, it's not governments that control pandemics, it's communities. And the community has got behind that. And we should be proud of our community spirit. And that we should, the prescription is that we should really work on that for the future. Another prescription is actually, in a sense, de-emphasizing identity and making it easier for people to find new identities. And I'm talking about LGBTQI, I'm talking about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, and I'm talking about us as Australians as well. Finding new identities which decrease boundaries, increase in community spirit. Easy to say, hard to do. Build together our own world together. And what are my wild hopes? Well, my one wild hope is that Australians lose their obsession with the United States and US politics, that we actually take a greater interest in Australian politics than we do American politics. A friend of mine came out here to give talks to Australian audiences on American politics. I warned her that she's talking to very knowledgeable audiences. And I suspect we as Australians know more about American cabinets than we do of our own. That we should really, as we come back to ourselves, take much more of an interest in ourselves. Another wild hope is that it won't take a catastrophe for us to change. Why did it take a catastrophe for so many things to change with COVID-19? An acute catastrophe. We're in the middle of a slow-moving catastrophe, which is climate change. Why are we waiting for something terrible to happen before we actually do things that are coherent and make a difference and that we actually see leadership on this issue? We should take a leaf out of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people's playbook, which is about control and it's about self-determination. We don't value that as much as we should in the non-Aboriginal community. And I think if some of these wild hopes come true, we'll be in a much better place. Thank you very much.
Dr. Norman Swan, once again demonstrating that 2020 taught us to favour expertise over optimism, even though occasionally hearing Norman predict that the future might not be all sunny felt like a kick in the guts. At least it feels like a well-informed kick in the guts, and that's how I like to double over. Gail Kennedy was Indigenous editor-writer at Streetwise Comics from 1995 to 1998. Her poetry collection, Koori Girl Goes Shoppin', was shortlisted for the David Yonayapon Award, an award that Gail later won in 2006 with Me, Ant-Man and Fleabag, which was also shortlisted for a Victorian Premier's Literary Award, Deadly Award and commended for the Kate Challis Racker Award. Gail's published 11 novels between 2011 and 2014 and has presented at writers' festivals, NIDOC events and nationally and internationally on her experience with polio and disability in general. Please welcome Gail Kennedy.
Thank you very much, everybody. In the Nyampa language, I like to say Yamakara, which is welcome, and thank you for having me. I just was thinking last year about the Chinese proverb, may we live in interesting times. And I never really knew what they meant as a curse, you know, and I never really knew what they meant until the last year or so. Now I know, may you live in interesting times, because we certainly are living in interesting times at the moment. Last year may have been a year of people losing work, But in a way, it was a great year for me and a great year for other artists, writers with disabilities, because the technology that had been there for years but was never, that they never really wanted to roll out for us, suddenly, when they found that people had to work from home, this technology was rolled out within 3 weeks. People could work from home, people could do talks from home, people, you could participate in the festivals that you weren't able to participate in before because of this technology. And we, people in wheelchairs, we people with physical disabilities that have spent, you know, so many years with our noses pressed up against the window panes looking in, suddenly were allowed in. And I used to wonder why we had to wait so long. But I thought, able-bodied people need to use this technology now. They need it. So they rolled it out quick, smart. And I and other of my friends were able to take advantage of it and you know, make money and participate in festivals as far away as Perth and Adelaide and Melbourne, and even local festivals, because suddenly they could dispatch a film crew, or you could use Zoom and be part and parcel of this. But when I started my writing career, I guess it would have started in 2006. I mean, when my book Me, Ant-Man and Fleabag came out, I was only invited to two writers' festivals, where all the other UNIAPAN winners were all over Australia. They were at all of the writers' festivals, and you know, a person from UQP asked, and they said, "Oh, well, we can't afford to pay for an assistant to go with her," and I mean, I was thinking, well, maybe you could ask one of the international writers if they'd like to donate their fee, seeing as they're probably coming over on business class or first class, and maybe shell out $200 for me to bring an assistant. But I think I was thought of as being difficult, and it should not have been a difficult thing. And so many of us don't get invited and are forever looking in, but not anymore, you see, because now we know that this technology is available. Now we know that we can participate in these particular avenues and these events. Then you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So now we're going to be demanding that you find a space and a way for us to participate in your festivals. And there was another thing I wanted to talk about particularly, is in the future, we need to look very carefully at the arts. I mean, the arts overall, and it's looked upon as being peopled by, I guess what you would say, woke people, people who are supposed to know what's going on, people who quite happily will wear a black armband in support of Indigenous artists. But when it comes to, when it actually comes to bums on seats, when it comes to actually having events that include Indigenous people, that include Middle Eastern people, that include Asian people, we're sadly lacking. And I'm looking around at what I see at most events that I go to at a mainly white audience. Why is that? Why aren't the people coming to events like this? What do we need to do to bring people to events like this? This is actually a disgrace in 2021 that we still haven't had that conversation. Why aren't they coming? Why are we not? Why am I not sitting here looking around at a sea of diverse faces? Because I'm not, and I don't. And we need to start looking at ways and means of engaging audiences from across the board, from across Australian society, and saying, this art, the arts are your arts. I mean, I've always thought that arts speaks a universal language, but it doesn't. I mean, it should speak a universal language. The arts should be the Tower of Babel, where we all understand what's going on. And I don't see that happening here in Australia. I look at television shows and I wonder, aren't you all tired of seeing the same old white faces, you know, on these panel shows? You know, aren't you tired of Mick Malloy and you know, and the token, you know, the token Asian, maybe Sam Pang or Waleed Ali? Don't you want some smart, mouthy Aboriginal people on there? Don't you want some smart, mouthy Asian people on there? I mean, aren't you sick to death of the homogenised Australian art scene, television scene, theatre? And Australia, unfortunately, ghettoises us. It ghettoises us as an audience. It ghettoises us as artists. It ghettoises us as writers. I mean, I wrote a comedy book, but it wasn't put in the comedy section. It was put in the Indigenous section. And people think that, that somehow reading Indigenous writing, I mean, it's changing, of course, now. But, excuse me, can I get someone to pass me some water? It's changing now because, you know, now Indigenous writers are winning the major awards and we're out there and we have Bangara. But these should not just be events where you wander along and you know, I know a lot of people speak to me and go, oh, I went to see Bangara the other night and they were just so wonderful. And I just, you know, why aren't we seeing more Indigenous people in our audiences? Why aren't we seeing more people on stage? Why aren't we mixing things up and why are we ghettoising people? Why, you know, I feel so sad when I know that Indigenous, Asian, Middle Eastern, African people are out there. They're doing their acting classes, they're doing their singing lessons, and I think, where are you going to practice this? Where's the space for you to practice this? And there doesn't seem to be any place, you know, like unless there's something specifically written for these people, you know. And then when you see television shows where they've actually got an Indigenous person or an Asian person or something, you just hear the faint hum of a didgeridoo in the background to announce that they're, oh, hey, we've got an Indigenous person here, or the faint sound of Asian music or Indian music, you know. I mean, you know, treating audiences like idiots for a start. And I think what I want to see in the future is I want to see an art sector that's vibrant and inclusive. I want to see an art sector that looks on artists with disabilities. You know, I think what happens is a lot of people look at the arts with, like, they look at it as some sort of therapy for people with disabilities. You know, oh, did you do a painting? Did you write a book? Oh, how clever of you. And that's not it. You know, we are brilliant, vibrant artists and we make, the arts is one good way for artists with disabilities to make a difference. There should be more of us on stage. There should be more of us on stage. There should be more of us on television. I mean, I've been screaming about this for years. So basically, I'm talking about the past. But why not? Why not this year? Why not this year? The art sector, the audience, why don't we all start talking about being inclusive, about wanting? See, I mean, I was told many years ago, I mean, with a straight face, well, it's not really what the audience want. And I'm going, well, who gives a fuck what they want? Put them on stage. They'll be fine. They'll get over it. You know, let's start being inclusive. Let's not break the hearts of the Indigenous kids, the African kids, the other people that are going to places like NIDA, who don't basically stand a chance of getting into the mainstream, appearing on, you know, getting chosen to you know, going to an audition knowing that they have half a chance of being chosen to appear on stage. And show people with disabilities in your shows. Put us on television. Take us seriously as artists. Pay us. You know, I've lost count of the number of times that people have asked me if I will do something for nothing. And no, I won't. And that's my form of activism. If you pay everyone else, then you pay me. Whether it's paid in kind, whether it's vouchers, but you pay me. I am worthy of being paid for my participation in your event. And I insist on that, and that is my form of activism. And I've found through speaking at other with other in, people with disabilities at conferences that it's getting through to them now. You know, you are worthy of being paid. And, you know, when they say, well, it's good exposure, I go, I don't need the exposure, I need the rent. And, you know, this is what we've got to start including people. We need to actually have an inclusive arts back. We need as artists to include everybody. And I mean, I don't mean it as a token. I don't mean that you tick the boxes. Yeah, I've got someone in a wheelchair. Yes, I've got someone. I mean, valued and on stage and in your libraries, valued on your television screens, valued as artists in their own right. And I'm actually really glad that I got to have a bit of a rant today about this. And you know, as audiences, you know, we need to start letting the people know, you know, that we want to see other people in the audience that are. We don't want to see an almost all white audience. We want to see an audience. We want to see a vibrant art sector that includes everybody. So thank you very much. I'm Gail Kennedy, and thank you for coming.
Thank you, Gail. And I think you may have coined an unofficial slogan for 2021, which is why not this year? On many fronts, we will be asking that. Jan Fran is an Australian Walkley Award-winning journalist and social commentator. She's the writer and creator of the viral internet opinion segment, The Frant, and is also known for her work on The Feed on SBS Viceland, The Project on Network 10, and the ABC podcast The Pineapple Project. Jan Fran has shot and produced documentaries from all over the world and appears regularly on Australian television as a social commentator. Her strong reporting on women's issues earned her a 2018 Walkley nomination for Women's Leadership in Media, and very excitingly, her memoir of Middle Eastern appearance will be published later this year. Please welcome Jan Fran.
Wow. So lovely to see so many half-covered faces in real life here. I'm very, very happy to be joining you today. And to bring you my predictions for 2021, I have relied on three Middle Eastern traditions that have been passed down from generation to generation. The first is the reading of coffee cups. I don't know if some of you are familiar with it. No, it's very accurate. I don't know if you know what Arabic coffee cups look like, but they're this small sort of cup that sits just in the dome of your hand. And legend has it that if you stare long and deep enough into the base of an Arabic coffee cup, and if you swirl the liquid slowly and with intent, that the future will reveal itself to you in the dark contours and shapes of the sediment. Now, for this to work, three things must be open: your heart, your mind, and Abdul's mixed business on the Hume Highway. I have stared into the coffee cup, and this is what I have seen for 2021. I see that the coronavirus is over. Yes, vaccines have worked. They've done the job that they were supposed to do, which is cure the world of anti-vaxxers. I see Donald Trump. He's making a new deal with his parole officer. He now shares a cell with someone called the My Pillow guy. Not sure. At Jack is now the supreme leader of America. Elon Musk, once Earth's richest man, is now Mars's richest cyborg. And all of the men who think he's cool have followed him there, where they listen to the Joe Rogan Experience together. The planet is healing itself. Greta Thunberg has retired to a home in the Swedish hinterland made entirely from recycled court depositions of all of the people who stormed the US Capitol. In Australia, Annabelle Crabb hosts a new show on the ABC, a whimsical look back at all the other shows she's hosted on the ABC. Love her. WA's borders remain permanently shut. But that's only to keep Basil Zemplis out of the other states. The Macquarie Dictionary's word of the year is Zoomstabating. Tensions with China escalate after a burning bag of poop is found on the steps of Parliament House. Tanya Plibersek is the leader of the opposition. I saw that one clearly in the sediment. I don't know about you. George Christensen is reprimanded for spreading the false claim that Peter Dutton is a decent person. Mark Latham dies while attempting to burn an effigy of Clementine Ford in a Red Rooster car park. An early federal election is called and the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, seeks help from God and God's one true son, Lachlan. Yes, the coffee cup has revealed much to me, but not all. So the second age-old tradition that I've relied on has been passed down to me by my mother and passed down to her by her mother before her and her mother before her. This delicate tradition is the domain of the wise Middle Eastern matriarch. It takes years, nay, I would say decades, to perfect, but it is often accurate in predicting what will happen. It's called guilt-tripping the fuck out of everyone around you so they do exactly what you want them to do. For example, you might say to your granddaughter, "I'm going to die soon. Why won't you have a baby?" Or apropos of nothing, you might declare at the dinner table, "None of my children love me." Or you might say something like, "Nobody ever asks how I'm doing." And then when someone does ask how you're doing, you say, "I'm fine." And then I say, "Well, clearly you're not fine, Mum." And she says, "Oh, so now you care, do you?" And I say, "Oh, wow, I'm so glad I came over." And she says, "Well, why don't you leave? Because I know that you're trying to get away from me." For example. Yes, the Arab Mum Guilt Trip, or AMGT as it's known, is actually very effective in eliciting behaviour change. And so, for 2021, I actually seek to apply this tradition to our leaders in the hope that we may see one or more of the following: federal action on climate change, the closure of all offshore detention facilities, the cancellation of the Sex and the City reunion series. Full accountability, including resignations, by ministers responsible for the robo-debt scandal. A First Nations voice to Parliament enshrined in the Constitution and the truth, the whole truth about our history taught in every school around the country. A pay rise for frontline nurses, cleaners, teachers, supermarket workers and drivers. A pay rise for the people that we need the most but pay the least. And finally, a bin large enough to fit anyone who refused to wear a mask in public because it was an infringement on their human rights. These are very much my wild hopes for the year of our Lord 2021. And look, I'm not above getting there by means of AMGT and or coercion of some kind. The third and final tradition is one that I learnt from my grandmother, also Jeanette Francis, or Nan Fran. Nan Fran passed away in 2020, kidney failure. She survived the decades-long civil war that took her husband. She survived the bruises and batterings of a lifetime that was spent in a country eternally on its knees. She survived getting hit by a speeding car on Punchbowl Road. We used to joke that if the apocalypse ever hit, the only survivors would be cockroaches and my grandmother. In the end, though, it was the salt that got her. It was slowly shutting her body down, and she knew that. But it turns out that my grandmother is the kind of person who would literally rather die than have a flavourless meal. Throughout her entire life, my grandmother would say daily, hourly even, she'd have this phrase that she would say, I'll say it to you in Arabic, Nishkar Allah, which is Arabic for thank God. And it didn't matter what was happening, it didn't matter where she was or who she was with or if she felt sick or well. She was just always forever perpetually thanking God, even in the hospital during her final days as her body swelled and her lungs drowned. And you would ask her, how are you going then? And she'd say, Shukr Allah. Thank God. Now, let's face it, we are at a writers' festival event in the most heathen postcode in Australia on a Sunday. I wouldn't necessarily call this crowd God-fearing. I could be wrong. But to thank God is to understand what I have come to learn, partly because of the events of 2020, that none of us are in control here, that things happen and they're shit, and there's nothing that you can do to make them go away. And sometimes your life changes, and you can't do anything to get your old life back. And what I learned is that this life, today, tomorrow, as much as we try, and we try all the time, sometimes it's all we do, as much as we try to control it, ultimately, it's just not really in our hands. And I do think that my grandmother knew that. I suppose you learn it very quickly when something terrible happens in your life. And I suspect that there are millions who have learnt that lesson in the worst possible way last year. And so my hope, and probably because I'm an optimist, my prediction moving into 2021 is that most of us will stop and be grateful for whatever it is that we have today, and grateful to whoever or whatever it is that has allowed us to be here. A gratitude that we are here today and a humility that we may not be here tomorrow. A gratitude even for the bin fire of the year that was 2020. I would even say especially for the bin fire of the year that was 2020. That is my 2021 prediction, hope, energy. I will be taking Nan Fran with me into 2021 and hopefully for the rest of my life. Thank you.
Thank God for Jan Fran. At Sydney Writers Festival, we are not, as an organisation, inclined towards predictions or prognostications. What we're inclined towards is planning. And I'm very excited to let you know that this year, from the 26th of April to the 2nd of May, Sydney Writers Festival will be back. We love being in the room with all of you. We have the most extraordinary writers, the most extraordinary plans that we're putting together. We hope to see you then. The program will launch in mid-March. A big thank you to Sydney Festival, who we've partnered with on the three events over the past couple of days, to the Sydney Writers Festival team, who are tireless and imaginative and very good at what they do. And please join me in thanking, once again, Maxine Beneba-Clark, Norman Swan, Gail Kennedy, Kate McClymont, and Jan Fran. We'll see you in April. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe to and rate our channel.